This is a podcast from The Red House, the former home of Benjamin Britten and Peter Piers. I'm Lucy Walker. Join me, colleagues and other guests for a monthly chat about all things Britten and Piers, plus music, culture, heritage in general, and anything else that might come up. Welcome to From the Red House podcast. This is number 10, and I'm delighted today to be joined by Juliet Fraser, singer, and she's speaking to me from Suffolk, actually, not too far away. So welcome, Juliet.
Thank you, Lucy. It's a real pleasure to speak to you.
Great. And so we're just going to just have a chat about all kinds of things, not least lockdown life and performance and commissioning and collaboration and all kinds of things. But just to start with, Juliet, perhaps we could have a little background as to your experience as a performer. When did it start and how did you get to where you are today?
Well, I think it started really with me as a very small person. I started playing the cello when I was about five, I think, and absolutely loved that. Both my parents are musical and were very supportive in that, so that kind of became, you know, one of the things that I did, a very strong part of my identity. And I went away to a specialist music school and then decided that it would be a great idea to start playing the oboe. So I was then an oboist quite seriously from about the age of 14 through until halfway through my university degree. And I was planning to go and do a postgrad as an oboist. That had been the game plan. And suddenly kind of lost my nerve and thought, actually, I'm not sure if that is what I want to do. Perhaps I'll stop playing over the summer holidays and see how much I miss it. And I never picked it up again. So that was that decision made. And I suppose all the way through I'd been doing bits of singing, but crucially when I got to university I started doing more singing in chapel choirs and that sort of thing, which was quite a new experience for me. As an alto with a range of about an octave, I was absolutely hopeless as a singer, but I could sing the right notes as long as they were within my range. It was in my last year at university that I got into a really good choir and was just very supported by the director there and started having singing lessons, and that's where it all began. And then it followed a, you know, a straighter path, sticking with the voice. I haven't yet changed instrument again. Through, I suppose, the English choral tradition, and I founded Exaudi with James Weeks in that first year, in fact, of working out whether I could be a singer. And so immediately had this split of early music and new music. And a big part of the vision for Exaudi was really to recreate my love of chamber music that had been throughout my life as an instrumentalist. I was trying to find a way to have that sort of music making, but as a singer.
Gosh, how interesting. I mean, not least the fact the world seems to be full of people who used to play the oboe.
I think it's... <Doesn't> it? I know, we're everywhere.
But I'm really intrigued by your original alto octave range. How did that become expanded so far north of that? Because you're such a high singer now.
Well, that's exactly right. It only went up. I was always pretty rubbish at the bottom, and it's still not my strong point, though it's getting stronger. I don't know. I suppose just a bit of training and a bit of confidence, really. But if you're set as an alto in a choir, then you never have the opportunity to explore it. And then when I changed choir and started having lessons, they immediately said, "No, of course you're a soprano." So that kind of took care of itself. I had to do it.
And you said about the split between early and contemporary music. I'm sure you're asked this all the time, but what is that affinity with the very early music and the contemporary music, that they quite often are paired, or singers tend to do both of those rep and not so much in the middle?
Yes. Well, I think that affinity comes both from the performer but also from the people listening. And I think for me there is a kind of aesthetic affinity between the two extremes. There tends to be a bit more emotional restraint in comparison with the music of the late 19th century, for example, and perhaps more of an interest somehow in the kind of overarching architecture. If you think of Renaissance polyphony and some of the interest in structure or form, or experiments with structure and form that come from the mid-20th century onwards. I think those are two points of comparison. But from the other direction, I think, again, since the mid-20th century, there's been a natural pull towards early music singers from the composers or ensemble creators or the people that put the new music on, preferring something pared back about the aesthetic of the actual sound of the voice. And it's associated with cleanness, with precision, which so many of composers of more complex harmonic worlds want that sort of sound. They don't want a blousiness, the blousiness of bad opera singing. And note that I say bad, because of course good opera singing is not blousy. But I think perhaps it's more helpful to think of the way that the voice in early music and contemporary music tends to be treated as an instrument, and it's, you know, it's blended with other instruments. If you think of Feldman's treatment of the voice or Bach's treatment of the voice, whereas if you're dealing with Lieder or opera, there's much more a distinction between the way that the voice sounds and the way that the instruments will sound. They're kind of existing in separate spaces.
Gosh, that's really interesting. I have often wondered about that and never really had it explained to me that coherently, so thank you for that.
Well, I don't know if that's coherent. I'm thinking on my feet a little, but you know, also these things self-perpetuate to a degree, so I think there are some problematic assumptions in there that that don't always serve as well, but to simplify it, I think that's one way of thinking of it.
So you're a very busy performer, obviously, in all manner of repertoire, but we are speaking now, we're now at the end of June, and this podcast will go out in probably a week or 10 days, so lockdown life will still be with us to some degree, and you have not been performing, doing what you do, for a number of months now.
Yes.
And I was partly inspired to talk to you because I was very intrigued by a piece you put on Eavesdropping, which is a group that you're involved in and have been for a while anyway, a very interesting symposium that you put together, and you were talking specifically about the what happens to your identity as a performer during this enforced period of not working. That was back in April, was it?
Yeah, that's right. So I wrote that talk on about the 20th of April, so we were 1 month into lockdown.
Yeah, and the things you were talking about then, is that still the case for you?
No, I would say that it's shifted. I think many of the themes that I was talking about still apply. Anxiety concerning how I return to work, anxiety about maintaining vocal fitness without all that much momentum, not really having a very clear sense of what the diary is going to look like. I suppose those are all still there. Those are just what comes with this period of huge uncertainty. But I think I was writing that at a time of particular anxiety, and I've found a sort of lockdown rhythm for myself, which is keeping me vocally fit and keeping me sane. I probably feel a bit more optimistic about things than I was when I was writing that paper.
Well, there was a suddenness about that you could hear when you were speaking, that it had only been a month, which is no time at all, really, considering it's the first month, I think, as you said, that, and you very rarely even take a full day's rest normally anyway, and then to have a whole month where you're just not able to work, whereas so the rhythm that you've got back into subsequently, has that involved rehearsing or
no? I make myself sing every day, but absolutely not rehearsing. July will mark the seismic shift in the lockdown life of Juliet Fraser when she's decided that she has to start singing new music again. So I haven't been learning any new scores or preparing anything, which I will have to be performing in the autumn as yet, but July and August are now put aside for that. So I've been having a lovely time singing all sorts of repertoire that I ordinarily might not explore, and doing other things. You know, spending much less time singing each day than I would ordinarily, but enjoying the opportunity to, I don't know, to explore other things creatively.
And has that made you feel differently about your about what you do as a performer? Do you think that will change something?
Honestly, I think probably not. I have spent some time thinking about what are the positive things that I've got out of lockdown and how I might be able to weave them into the future times. I have a slight psychological barrier with that, I think, because I don't feel that it's going to be for me to decide in the immediate future. I think so much of this is out of my control. If and when I'm summoned to return to stage, I want to be able to do that. I'm sure it's different for different people, and I feel very fortunate because new music suffers from many things in many ways. But currently, because we have quite small audiences, and because so much of my own work is on the continent, it looks like I'm going to be returning to something approaching normal activity at the end of August.
Right.
And I'm well aware that that's quite a bit before everybody else. And certainly all my work in the UK is cleared through until next year. So yeah. I don't know. I think it's very difficult to make general predictions about what will happen. Yeah.
But it sounds like that so the green shoots on the continent are certainly there, and that's the majority of your work.
Yeah, for a few years now, I would say that it's probably been about 80% of my work, and yes, everything that I will be doing between August and December this year will be on the continent. But that's sad, you know. Yeah. I feel on the one hand incredibly grateful for that, and on the other hand incredibly frustrated. I'm fearful about whether it's going to be possible to travel as much as I need to from the UK to the continent. So I'm having to look at options for basically living out of a suitcase for 3 months in various European cities. So yes, there's still a lot of uncertainty. It's a very unpredictable and uncertain time still.
Yeah. How about recordings? Because you do a lot of recordings as well. Is there any signs of that reviving?
Yes, that's an interesting question. I suppose one would have thought that might happen first, but no, not really. I was supposed to be doing some recording sessions in June, which were cancelled, of course, and we're rescheduling them. But there hasn't yet been any. I like to think of myself as being very creative and proactive, and in some ways I think I am. But actually, through this whole process of the impact of the pandemic, I feel a bit like people fall into one of two categories. There are the people that immediately reinvent what it is they do to cater to the situation, and there are those that don't. And I'm definitely in the second category. And I feel like I'm waiting to find out if there will be a way for me to carry on doing what it is that I do, because I love doing what I do. I'm a performing artist first and foremost. I don't particularly enjoy recording, to be honest, even if I think it's very important to do. I like performing to people and with people.
What is it? What do you love about that? What's the thing?
I think it's this might sound like a contradiction, but it's the safety net of not being able to look back. You simply have to sing the next bar, no matter what has happened.
I love that phrase. I'm just sort of...
Well, yeah. I don't know if that... Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. It does. There's no... Yeah, there's no room for all the constant doubt that you, most of us kind of...
That's it.
Inhabit
Once
all
you
the
have
time.
To turn that off, yes. And of course I do inhabit it all the time, and that's what you're trained to inhabit when you're rehearsing. Total nightmare. But you have to turn it off when you're performing. And I like that. Going for it. That's what I like. I like the space to take risks, which you don't so... Well, often I find I don't so much have in rehearsal, and certainly in recording sessions, it's just a totally different psychology, and not such a comfortable one for me.
No, because you're in your recording, your second eye or ear or whatever brain is judging what you're doing all the time, because you can go back and alter it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Whereas in a live performance, then you're committed to that moment, and that's it. for yes. what, for good or bad. Yeah.
And people remember the energy much more than the detail. You know, it's about yeah. creating an atmosphere. It's so much more than the notes. It's really an energy that you're conveying.
So I can understand why you'd fall into that second camp rather than being in the first group of people who might have sort of then done lots of internet recording or lots of live streaming, or because you don't get any of that feedback and you can go away and tweak
right.
and so on. So that, yeah, I guess that makes yeah. that makes sense. That's not going to feed you particularly.
No,
that form of
me.
Performing. Yeah, that's the opposite of being fed by it. Yeah, yeah. And just in terms of vocal, getting back your vocal fitness, because I've struck, I've been obviously listening to a number of your recordings lately, and the your vocal fitness in particular, or a singer who tackles such quite strenuous and challenging repertoire as you do, to get back to the stage where you know you're not going to damage yourself, because some of the recordings and performances I've seen of you, it sounds like you're doing crazy things with your voice that just sound like, I was listening to something, you were being a crow or something in a,
oh, yes.
a piece earlier, and that was
I know what you've so, been listening to.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then stratospherically high and really doing incredible athletic things with your voice that must take a lot of physical training.
Well, I suppose it does, yes, but I wouldn't say that any of those things are intrinsically damaging. I think we can end up with a very narrow notion of what the voice can do if we listen to a very narrow range of music. But the human voice, if you just use it to communicate through speech, is incredibly varied. You know, we can shriek at one another, we can wail, we can gnash our teeth or imitate things, and we don't think about the vocal damage that we're doing. We just use it as an expressive instrument, and I think that's the same
with
the singing voice. That's why there are all sorts of musical genres that employ very different sounds and techniques, but the artists can maintain those sounds for the full length of an evening performance, you know, whether it's kind of rock or you know, heavy metal with all that
yeah.
going on. it's all just about knowing your instrument and knowing its limitations, and I'm extremely careful about never doing anything that my body says, yeah, I'm not sure I want to do that. So
yeah.
it's all very carefully managed.
Well, that which leads us very neatly onto the subject of your work with contemporary composers and as a commissioner of
yeah.
new music and that collaborative role. How do you go about the process of commissioning a composer? How's someone's work you're attracted to and you want to work with them?
Well, actually, it can happen in quite a few different ways, you know. So sometimes it's me approaching a composer and really building the whole project from the ground up, so asking them to write for me, then selling the idea to promoters, and then fundraising and really doing the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that, I suppose, every couple of years, or as much as I have the energy to do. Sometimes a composer will approach me and they might basically do exactly the same role, so sell the project and find the funding for it. Sometimes a festival will kind of broker the relationship, or might be talking to either one of us and will support it as a co-commissioning partner. So, and that's of course my favourite way, because it takes the pressure off me and the composer. It liberates us to do our creative work with this structural support. And also it's so much easier to sell a project to other promoters if you've got a good partner already on board. So those are some of the ways that it tends to work, but it's pretty different in every instance, really.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And then the actual, you've hinted at it already, the actual process of that composer then writing a piece kind of on or about your voice or with your voice, that it's, I mean, I'm partly interested in this subject because we have this, we've been looking at that this year at the Red House in terms of our exhibition about Britain's writing so much music for Peter Piers and around his, the particular nature and characteristic of his voice so closely that then actually having somebody writing with your voice in mind, how what that must like be for you to sing it, and also then I suppose ultimately what's like for other people to then sing that who come after you.
Well, the first thing I'd say is that it's far from a given that the process of commissioning somebody or working with a composer on a new piece for you will actually be collaborative. And I don't at all say that in a negative way, because what I understand to be true collaboration is a very long and deep and often quite uncomfortable process by which both partners or all partners involved are somewhat transformed by the process of finding, building a working method together. So lots of people have written me pieces without me being very involved, frankly. I mean, right. I'm lucky if they ask my vocal range. It's a good idea if they do. But they may listen to recordings or whatever, but they're probably isn't a lengthy process of experimentation or development together or workshopping or whatever. Then doesn't always need to be that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't term that collaboration, even if it's still a commission and even if it is written for me.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing bad about that. Some of the pieces that I most love to sing have been written in that way.
Mm-hmm.
It was just unnecessary for us to work any more closely or to find some sort of common language.
Mm-hmm.
And then the pieces that really have emerged from a much more collaborative process, I think yes, it's fair to say that they do feel extremely tailored to me, and not just to my voice, because after all that does change a bit as one ages, and even if one's tired, or it changes depending on what else you're singing in the programme, for example. But they feel tailored to me as a person as well as a vocalist. So often I feel these pieces are coming out of conversations about who I am or who we are, the composer and I, at that moment, what our creative preoccupations are, what we're looking for this collaboration to explore. And the whatever comes out of that then is something quite personal. So you have a very different bond with it. And of course, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, so the bond isn't necessarily all positive.
No, I can imagine. I had read something you'd written where the collaborative process feels incredibly equal, so you're equal participants in that process.
I would say if it's a healthy collaboration, then there is an equality, yes.
Yeah, but from the outside world, that's not always the perception. It's as the composer is higher up the hierarchy in terms of other people's perception, yeah.
I think often, and sometimes that's not done consciously, but if you just think about the practicalities of the way that a piece is listed on a billing, or the way that forms are filled out when you're giving information of a programme, that those structures and those traditions are quite embedded, and my collaborative partners and I have found that we do have to check time and time again that people aren't collapsing into the expected hierarchies, that it is possible to publicise or to bill a work that has been written in a collaborative fashion if we're pursuing co-authorship, that it is listed correctly, and that collaborative process is reflected in the way that the work is described.
Yeah. No, yes, absolutely, and I think.
But it's a challenge to the norms. That's all. Yeah. So it takes a lot of attention from everybody to change those norms.
Yes, because of the normal. Written by, performed by.
Quite.
Yes, it's the usual setup. Yeah, for yeah. sure. So what we've been doing at the end of each podcast is discussing what music we've all been listening to lately. Mm. And the idea is it can be so a couple of things you've heard recently or just that you want to evangelise about. And then it goes on our Red House podcast playlist.
Oh, wow. Oh, well, that's an opportunity to shake things up a bit, isn't it?
Yes, go for it.
Oh, there is one album immediately that comes to mind, and it's by a Polish woman called Anna Zaradny, and she's a composer and improviser, electroacoustic artist, I suppose, and I was spending quite a bit of time researching, well, electroacoustic artists in that sort of genre, and which wasn't a world that I knew a lot about. And she was one of the people that I discovered and absolutely fell in love with. And the album that I've been listening to is, oh, I can't remember exactly what it's called, but something to do with Theurgy. Mm. Theurgy 1 and Theurgy 2 are the two tracks. It's just a two-track album.
Okay.
And I have absolutely been loving that. That's something that I've been listening to now for probably about 5 months.
Oh, wow. Okay. What's keeping you at them for 5 months? What's so great about them?
It's just really strong music. It has an energy about it that it just kind of puts me in a frame of mind that is it's like, yes. And sometimes I need that.
Brilliant.
You'll understand. You only have minutes of it to get to understand that, I think.
Absolutely. No, I'm there. Fantastic. Then, was there anything else?
Yeah, there are two other things that come to mind. So a dear friend of mine, Andrew Hamilton, who's an Irish composer but based in Birmingham, he's just released a new album called Joy, which is him singing and playing on his violin his own pieces. And he's such an extraordinary mind and man. Mm. And it's so tender and brave and sad and joyful. So I've actually only listened to that once, but that's firmly in my playlist. Love that. And then an older discovery is a French vocalist called Gedalia Tazartez, who I discovered through Ilan Volkov, who's a rapacious consumer of, well, not consumer, but absorber of musics of all kinds. And he introduced me to Gedalia's music, and I love it. That's very different. That's three very different
fantastic
things for your playlist.
Oh, great. We love a range. That's super. Well, I just add my two. Michael Tippett, which I haven't listened to. Yes.
What Tippett have you been listening to, Lucy?
Well, this is his third string quartet.
Oh.
The slow movement thereof. And this was recommended to me by, perhaps not surprisingly, his biographer, Oliver Soden, exhibition with last year, and have stayed in touch, and he did one of our podcasts as well. And we were having an unusually highbrow chat. We normally kind of, to be honest, exchange Victoria Wood quotes, which I think is a good way of spending a lockdown as any. But we were talking string quartets, and he recommended the slow movement of this quartet as a kind of visionary piece of music that you just don't know where it's going and what it's doing. And it's this full kind of liberation from any norm of any description at all, whereas he was kind of comparing them to Britain, who writes beautiful music, but it's often very contained within a form or within a set of rules, whereas Tippett is just, and it is quite mind-expanding, this particular movement. So I was really struck by that. So that's going on. And then at slightly the other end of this, well, of some spectrum or other, is I was just listening to, on my lunchtime walk, Paul Simon's 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, which is a really, really good song to walk to.
Excellent.
So, though, I think we win the prize for the most eclectic group of songs for the...
Yes, that's what I'm
I think we do.
For.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. This has been really stimulating and inspiring conversation to have had on a Thursday afternoon. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Lucy. Thank you for the opportunity. It's just really nice to speak to you. So thank you for having me.
Bye for now.
Bye.